It's 2 o'clock, and it's time now for our weekly visit and a conversation with Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist. Good afternoon, Elizabeth. What's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Brad. Today, I am thinking about my wonderful weekend that I had that just passed, reuniting with friends that I've known, people I went to school with from kindergarten all the way through high school, some through junior high, through high school. There was a gathering that was really special because we were there to celebrate one of our fellow students. And I've grappled with whether or not to share this because it just sounds so braggy. But right. I didn't do anything. It's not me. But the fact remains that one of our close friends in my friend group received the Nobel Prize for Medicine last year.
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
Again, I didn't earn it, but in my friend group. So that's pretty exciting. And so we threw together, and I did not do that either. Some of our very organized friends threw together kind of a mini reunion to celebrate Fred Ramsdell, Dr. Ramsdell. And we met at our high school, Homestead High School in the Bay Area, which is kind of braggy to say we also went to high school with Steve Jobs, but he was a little older than us. So the Homestead High School has now churned out some pretty amazing people. But it was really, it was a wonderful experience because we met at the high school in the old auditorium that we did so many performances in high school. And I remember sitting there thinking, why is it so much smaller? Because I remember being on stage looking out thinking, oh, this must be 1,000 people here, but it's not that large. But it was a great ceremony for Fred, and there was dignitaries that came and spoke. Ro Khanna came, a state legislator, and gave a presentation, and a lot of students were there. But for me, besides that event and getting to reconnect, Fred, to reconnect, there was about 50 to 60 of these people that were so formidable in my life. And that's great when you get to go to school. I don't know, for some people it's great, for some people maybe not so great, but to have been in the same school district from kindergarten all the way through high school, that continuity and those friendships that were made were really long lasting. But here's the thing. The gathering was fabulous and so much fun. But when I saw everyone, and some people, actually, there's a tight group of my closest friends that I've stayed close to, and we're in contact regularly. We have the text chain, the Mustang Girls text chain, the 10 of us. So they're there. So that's kind of my comfort zone. I've known them forever. We're still really close. But then there were, 50 other people that I really haven't seen, some not since school and some maybe a couple times or off and on. But when I saw these people, all the hugs are happening. The thing that came up most commonly was, oh, Elizabeth, you haven't changed a bit. Oh, you haven't changed at all. Like, I heard that so much. You haven't changed. You haven't changed. And as the day went on, and especially, after the event, and I was home kind of replaying everything that happened. And of course, I always am critically thinking back about everything that I said and kind of criticizing or being okay with it. But that's just kind of my own neurotic response to group events, and also being on the radio and also being a professor, that my evenings are very long having to recap everything that came out of my mouth. But having said that, as I was thinking back over the day, I thought, I wonder if it's a bad thing or a good thing that so many people said, oh, you haven't changed at all. Oh, I'm so glad you haven't. You're just you. You're still you. But they didn't say specifically what it was that about me that hasn't changed. Like, clearly I've grown older, but it felt more like my personality hadn't changed. And I was thinking, I don't know if that's a great thing that I would go from, graduating from high school when I'm 18 to becoming 65, and then to have this group of people that have also are 65 to look at me and say, you're still the same, you haven't changed. And if I were to guess, because again, I didn't take a poll on the spot, although believe me, I was totally curious and wanted to do little dinner table roundtable. It's like, let's all chime in and share what it is about each other that we think hasn't changed. But I didn't get to that. But it also would have been very aligned in why my childhood friends think I haven't changed. Because I can tell you the three main things that have kind of lingered throughout my life I was nominated in junior high and high school as biggest flirt in the class. Now, I didn't win either time, but I was nominated both times. And that has always kind of bothered me. Not that I didn't win.
Okay.
But the fact that, you know, aside from all the things they did in high school, that was the standout thing. And then they would pretty much universally say that I'm very talkative, which I also find interesting because, yes, I get paid to talk, but outside of my jobs where I get paid to talk, I feel that I'm fairly introverted and pretty quiet. I'm not super social, but they would all probably say talkative. And then they would all pretty universally say that I was pretty blunt or direct, that I never was really good at couching things or, you know, being more subtle, that I was a bubblegum machine of things in my head and things come out. So I would think those things, if I did a brief poll, would be it. And I think I'm so curious to know what the other things would be. And the reason that I have stuck on that is that also this week in class, I've been talking about the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, which is the reference book that is used by mental health professionals to label and diagnose people who come in with mental health issues. And there's been this kind of crossover now of this idea of labels and diagnoses, but mostly labels, the things that get attached to us and how it is we respond to those labels. If they're positive, then it tends to uplift us and make us feel seen and witnessed, you know, especially if the label is something we are proud of or want it to be part of who our identity is, then that can feel really empowering. But if the label that it gets hung on us is not really, one, flattering, or two, really correct or accurate as to who the person sees themselves to be, it can be really challenging. That mislabeling can feel like a burden, and it can also be really painful. And it's also incredibly hard to shake a label once it's been kind of handed over to you. And that goes for the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the DSM, and then it also goes to our friend groups and our relationships and how people see us and view us, and also in our families, you know, the labels that we take on in our families, the simple ones like I'm the oldest, or, you know, you're the funny one, or someone's an athlete, or those labels, or the difficult child, or the black sheep. Once they get kind of hung on you in a family system, they're also very hard to shake. Because in a family system, how the family knows itself as a group, as a system, kind of depends on everybody having their role that they enact or that they play out, and that brings stability to the family. And that's not just, you know, best behavior, but it can be the behaviors that aren't so attractive either. You know, there might be the person who, again, is the black sheep or the troublemaker or the person, you know, with an addiction issue or the person with mental health issues. Like, everyone in the family has a role and a position and a way that the family learns to interact with each other based on those labels and roles. But in that family systems, when someone changes, maybe they get clean and sober, or maybe they are no longer the black sheep, but they're actually really successful and they find their way in the world. Or maybe they were once really successful, you know, the golden child, and then they're not so golden anymore. When someone in the family changes, the whole system gets disrupted and it becomes kind of this awkward, how do we interact with each other? How do we kind of know who we are as a family because this one piece has been changed? And that disruption can really cause fractures in family relationships. But more often than not, those fractures in family relationships happen when someone has changed and the family refuses to acknowledge the change because it's too uncomfortable, because it's challenging to change the way we see each other. And so as a result, the family doesn't make adjustments to allow for the change in individuals in the family. And that individual can feel isolated or kind of alone or angry or resentful. And so we can see family issues along that way, along that line as well. And so for today's conversation, I was going to throw out a question and Jackie's here today also, and you, so I want you to think about it, and also I'm putting out to everyone else, like, what are those labels that you have, that you carry? And are there labels that are positive? And are there labels that are hindering to you, that have actually caused you harm or kept you from really excelling or pursuing things in your life? You know, what are those labels? And then the second part, I'm going to talk about the DSM and how that giant reference book has impacted and continues to impact people's lives on a regular basis, because at the heart of the DSM is the process of diagnosing and then labeling someone with a mental illness and how that can impact their life. So that's what's on my mind today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875 to be part of the conversation. If you're willing to share kind of those labels that you've experienced throughout your life or that you maybe still carry today and how they impact you. And you can also find me after the show by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can find me on Facebook or Instagram. You can also listen to previous shows at kcbx.org, where years and years of shows exist for you to peruse. Or if you'd like to stay current with the show, you can now podcast our show by visiting Spotify or Apple Podcasts or NPR Podcasts or wherever it is that you look for podcasts. Search A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe. And if you leave a review, that would also be helpful to help other people find our show as well. So that's where we're off to. I'm going to take a quick break and come back, open up the phone lines, continue the conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Have you ever felt like nobody was there? Have you ever felt forgotten in the middle of nowhere? Have you ever felt like you could disappear? Like you could fall and no one would hear. Well, let that lonely feeling wash away. Maybe there's a reason to believe you'll be okay. 'Cause when you don't feel strong enough to stand, you can reach out your hand and oh, someone will come running, and I know they'll take you home. Even when the dark comes crashing through, when you need a friend to carry you, and when you're broken on the ground, you will be found. So let the sun come streaming in, 'cause you'll reach.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And when I label myself, and this show often for years started with kind of an introduction of me, wife, mother, grandmother, educator, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator. But those labels say very little about me as a person or how it is that I actually move through the world. It's just the roles that I play, labels and that I have earned or that I have chosen. All of those are chosen roles and labels. But then there are the unchosen roles and labels. And honestly, as I mentioned at the top, I'm not sure really how people perceive me. I mean, I've had feedback over the years that's pretty consistent, which includes things like compassionate, which is nice. Never, ever have I been called sweet, which is fine because I don't think that exists in me. But compassionate, yes. Loud, direct, intimidating, helpful, witty. Those are things that I have heard. But they also don't really have anything to do with, again, how I show up in the world in my own way, in myself, right? What is underneath the way that I react to my world around me, whether it's being talkative or direct or witty or loud. But the driving piece underneath it has been a lot of anxiety since the time I was young. That drives a lot of that personality that my classmates have said I haven't changed at all. And in some ways, they're correct. I started having a lot of anxiety when I was a young kid, and it kind of pushed and through most of my life and has been part of my experience. But it's changed and morphed as I've changed and morphed. And I remember my dad saying to me, when I was in college, when I went to college, he said, you're going to outlive the anxiety, because he's an anxious human too, as was my grandmother. He said, you're going to outlive it. At some point, you're going to have been around long enough that nothing about it can scare you anymore, and you'll have moved beyond it. And in a lot of ways, he's right. But also, it's part of the reason that I have been so interested in my profession and becoming a therapist, because anxiety is the most common mental health concern that people come into therapy for, closely tied to or connected to depression. And for many people, they have depression and anxiety go hand in hand. And in that realm, like that knowing of myself, there's the public presentation, and then there's that personal interior experience, and how that interior experience kind of shows up in the world impacts how people perceive us. And I remember, again, always thinking that if someone looked at me, they would know for sure that I was feeling like I was going to, you know, burst out of my clothes and run down the street, or my hair would catch on fire, whatever like that anxious response was. But then also realizing, oh, no one knows. No one knows what I'm experiencing internally. I got so good at being able to present myself in a fluid and professional way, that whatever was churning, you know, the victory at sea churning inside of me was never really present. And in all honesty, there are many, many shows in the 18 years I've done this show, of the 1,000 shows, that if I listen back to them, I go, wow, you can't even tell that I was like barely able to stay in my skin for that hour.
Right.
And so I think about, one, how we're perceived. Two, how it is we connect our mental health care system to people's identities and their well-being, and how the process of connecting people to mental health care in some ways can be have a negative impact on their lives. And I'm speaking directly about the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual.
I've got a question about the DSM, if I can interject that. Why, you know, we refer to it quite a bit when we're talking about diagnoses, but why is the DSM the only reference book for mental health care? What's the history and the reasoning behind this?
Thank you for asking that question. Because I wasn't going to go that far back, but actually I'm going to, because the foundation of the DSM is fascinating. The first year that the DSM was released was 1952. But at that time, the 1950s, there were actually 5 separate diagnostic classification systems in the United States. There was one for the insane asylum system, which you would think they would have been called something else, but it was called the insane asylum system. There was the Army had their own diagnostic classifications. The Navy had their own. The Department of Veteran Affairs had their own diagnostic classifications. And the American Prison System. And the reason this is so important is because the DSM mirrors those 5 diagnostic systems. It pulled them all together and created one system, one reference book. And this reference book, if you really then think of the foundation or the genesis of it, is based on the idea of normal would be those who are not in an insane asylum, are not in prison, and would be good soldiers that could be part of the military, Army, Navy, or the Veteran Affairs. And that means in these classifications, they were discerning if someone was loyal, would follow orders, non-reactive, not overly emotional, not dramatic, was, you know, willing to run into battle, not too tied to their internal fear system. And so if you look at those factors that were considered the personality traits of a good soldier. And then you look at the DSM, because there is no normal. In the DSM, there is no, here is what normal looks like. It's just a book of disorders. But the unspoken piece of it is all of these are the disorders, and anyone without these would then be considered normal. But if you look at all of those disorders, the only one left who would be normal would be unfeeling, willing to run into battle, not overly reactive, not emotional, not traumatic, and basically someone numb to their experiences, but still brave and courageous and willing to, you know, go to war. And so if you look at the foundation of the DSM from the very beginning, basically our entire mental health system is built on the idea that we, if we are normal, are going to be good soldiers. We are going to mirror those characteristics. And that in itself, to me, has always been a concern about the entire existence of this book, because the foundation of our mental health care system is then trying to get people patched up so they can go to war, whichever that looks like, if it's at Google or if it's, you know, sitting behind a desk of any kind. How do we patch people up so that they don't, so they aren't overly reactive and overly feeling, and that they can run into battle, whatever their battle is? And that is challenging for me when I look at our overall mental health care system. The other part of this book that people don't think about, or why would you, is that at the same time that the DSM was being created, after World War II, I have to back up. During World War II, the primary mental health care provided for the soldiers, for the military, were psychiatrists, because they were the only ones trained in talk therapy at that time. There were no other talk therapists. Psychologists at that time only worked in universities, and they only did research and assessments. They did not do clinical counseling. That's not what they were trained to. PhDs, psychologists did not do it. But there were so many thousands and thousands of soldiers that were wounded, but also suffering from battle neurosis on the front lines, that the military started enlisting these PhD psychologists and had the psychiatrists train them quickly to become talk therapists, to do talk therapy, so they could get them into the front lines to help the soldiers and to help them at home. Now, part of that was really successful because it brought more clinicians into the field. But for psychiatry, it was a kind of a downturn in their profession, because after World War II, many of the psychologists who had worked said, oh, I like that talk therapy part. I'm going to continue doing that. And the National Institute of Mental Health was formed in 1949, and they started funding universities to create training programs to train psychologists to do talk therapy. So this usurps the whole world of the psychiatrists, who were the only talk therapists, and now they're getting kind of pushed back into only working with severely mentally ill people in hospitals, and the psychologists now newly trained in the universities and being funded by the National Institute of Mental Health are going into the public and doing private practice and working in places. The reason that's important is because the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association, it's very important, they're different. The American Psychiatric Association is the one who writes and publishes the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the DSM. It's owned by the American Psychiatric Association. They make $5 million a year owning this information. But it was a way that the American Psychiatric Association could retain some sort of power over the field of mental health, because they owned the book and determined what disorders went in there. And the psychologists, as they became the largest branch of talk therapists, as a matter of fact, side note, the term counseling psychologist was coined by the Veterans Administration during World War II to give a name to these academic psychologists who were now doing therapy. So the whole field of counseling psychology was created to support the war effort. So there's so many crossovers in the military's impact on the mental health care, and the mental health care views of what is normal, from the DSM, from how psychologists came to be, and from the world of psychiatry trying to hang on to their power. that challenges me as a professional thinking about what the basis of mental health and wellness is. I hope that answered your question. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. And we're talking about labels, whether they're the labels that you receive from your family, from friends, from your peer group, or from the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. I'm not going to just say the DSM. If you go in for any sort of mental health care, that's how you're going to be labeled and how you're going to actually receive care. Because the only way clinicians can get paid for their treatment if they take insurance is to write a treatment plan. And our treatment plans are based on the diagnosis from the DSM. So to go back, Brad, to your original question.
Okay.
I realize I went way off book.
That's okay. This is a fascinating conversation, and I know I'm learning a lot, and
okay,
I know
good.
Our audience is too.
I'm in my professor mode for sure. But the reason it's the only book is because the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, owns that. And they determine that that's the common reference that's going to be used in the United States. But interestingly, it's not the primary resource for 193 other countries in all of Europe. They actually use the ICD, which is the International Classification of Disorders. And that book actually classifies all mental health and physical conditions. And it's been in existence. The ICD's been in existence for like 100 years. And it's run and overseen. It's been run and overseen by WHO, the World Health Organization, since 1948. And it's multidisciplinary, it's multilingual, it's global in its reach. But we, the United States, in our mental health care field, don't use it as part of our practice.
Of course.
Yeah. So
their definition of mental health and our definition of mental health diverge in some a little bit here.
Yes. And that's a good point as well, because what we've come to understand about mental health care in the modern era, they call everything past 1980 the modern era. I think we're probably post-modern era now. Is this idea that our mental health is not just a biological response. It's physiological, it's spiritual, it's, you know, psychological, it's many, many facets. And so in order to diagnose something, someone with anything, you really have to take into account all of those different, what's the socioeconomic level of this person? What is their environment like? What is their family history like? All of these pieces. What is their day-to-day situational experience like? In order to make an accurate diagnosis of anything, we have to understand someone in their complex life. And the ICD actually has more capacity to do that than, because it deals in the physical and mental health of human beings. The DSM is really limited to mental health and brain-related conditions. And I really want to say something about the brain.
Okay. Say it. Let's hear it.
And of course, this wasn't the direction today I was going, but I can't stop myself. The interesting thing about neuroscience, because neuroscience is incredibly popular, you know, our psych students love all the neuroscience classes, and this idea that neuroscience was going to change mental health care and was going to solve all of our issues because they were going to figure out how the brain works, and that way we could heal people. But there was an interesting article that came out when Tom Insel, who was the former director of the National Institute for Mental Health, and he retired in 2017. When he retired, this was his outgoing statement, and I'm paraphrasing it, that over the time that I served in the NIMH, I helped to fund a lot of cool papers about cool brain science by really cool scientists. We invested about $20 billion in this research, in these papers. That was 90% of our budget. We only allocated 10% of our budget to go directly towards mental health issues that impacted society and families and individuals. And I am sad to report, and again, I'm paraphrasing, that at the end of my tenure, we did not move the needle at all in helping to address homelessness, poverty, depression, anxiety, OCD, suicide, and those common factors that impair people's mental health. That we had these cool research studies, but none of it healed or cured a person or came up with a treatment plan. And so, as much as neuroscience is exciting, the direct care for individuals has been stalled for a really long time. And we still lean on the DSM as the place to go to try to understand how people are suffering or what the diagnosis would be to explain their suffering. And the DSM has grown since 1952. It was a 32-page pamphlet with 106 diagnoses. By 2022, which is the latest iteration, the DSM-5 with a text revision, there are 298 diagnoses and 992 pages. And yet our capacity to actually heal people, cure people, has stalled. That we have a lot of information about how people can be struggling, but we have still very little good information about how people get better.
But isn't it a good thing to have more diagnoses so, you know, more people can get help? I mean, and how do therapists know, what treatment to use?
Well, that's a longer, I'll give a short answer, then I'll come back after the break with a longer one. But the short answer is this. Yes, a lot of diagnoses would be a great idea if we had the treatment plans to help people get better. But we now just have a lot of ways of labeling people, and those labels can be a challenge. And I like to use this analogy that with 298 diagnoses, it's like throwing a net into the sea and just dragging in everything you can in the hopes that you catch a goldfish. And in the meantime, you've brought in all sorts of sea creatures that had no business being in the net. They were just living their life. And the goldfish generally is so small, it's going to swim out of the net and we don't catch it. But the idea is that if we capture everyone with a diagnosis, we won't miss anyone along the way. But the problem is the goldfish represent that 1% of the population that have severe mental illness, psychosis, major depressive disorder, you know, major bipolar disorder. And those are the people who rarely come in for treatment. And so we're casting a net and dragging in lots of people who probably would have been okay, and we're missing still that goldfish, those people who could really use care but don't get seen. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875 to be part of the conversation. We're going to take a quick break and come back and open up those phone lines, continue the conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
I gave all my oxygen to people that could breathe. I gave away my money and now we don't even speak. I drove miles and miles, but would you do the same for me? Oh, honestly. Offered up my shoulder just for you to cry upon. Gave you constant shelter and a bed to keep you warm. They gave me the heartache, and in return I gave a song. It goes on and on. Life can get you down, so I just numb the way it feels. I'll drown it with a drink and out-of-date prescription pills. And all the ones that love me, they just left me on the shelf. No farewell. So before I save someone else, I've got to save myself.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875, and we're broadly talking about the idea of labels today and how those labels can impact our life, whether they're the labels that our friends give us or the labels that we were given in our families as we were growing up, or in another general context, the labels that are handed out to people, not handed out, that sounds kind of small, but those labels that people are given when they're diagnosed with a mental health issue or mental illness. And there's a couple more things I want to add about the DSM, because again, nothing is all bad or all good. People who get a diagnosis through the DSM, if they've been struggling with mental health issues for a long time, will often say, oh, I feel so relieved. I knew there was something wrong and there was not a name for it. And I just feel better knowing that it's something. Also, for people who finally get a diagnosis and their families have really struggled along with them, it quite often families are more compassionate when they know that it's something and they're more tender with their loved ones. So there are places where that diagnosis can be beneficial and can help the individual. And also, as I mentioned, for the managed care world, in order to get reimbursements for insurance, you have to have some sort of diagnosis and a treatment plan that goes along with it. Now, having said that, the parts that concern me, again, are one, how limiting these diagnoses are, because once you are given a diagnosis, it pretty much stays with you. And for many people, it can become their identity, where they might, you know, someone might consider themselves an athlete or a scholar or a musician or, you know, a lover of nature, a backpacker, all these ways that we can identify ourselves and labels that feel empowering. When someone receives a diagnosis of generalized anxiety disorder or OCD or depression in some kind, it starts to take on a life of its own within the person's psyche. And quite often people will start to refer to themselves or their life as my anxiety, or my anxiety prevents me from doing this, or my OCD is causing this to happen, or my depression is keeping me from having relationships. It takes on a whole identity that overwhelms the rest of the person's entire existence. That whole life force that person once had or could tap into gets smothered by the heaviness of this mental health diagnosis. And again, a diagnosis can be helpful for the parts of the mental health care world that I mentioned, but it also can be a heavy burden because it's hard to shake. And while we're talking about the DSM, how do these diagnoses, the 298 of them, get into the book? How are they put into the system? They're put in by vote. They're put in by panels and task force committees that come together to discuss latest science, the latest diagnoses. People propose diagnoses that are discussed. And in this current DSM-5, there were 170 panel members. And of those 170 panel members who had a say in what was added to the DSM, 56% of them had one or more ties to Big Pharma, a direct tie. 100% of those panel members who were assigned to work on mood disorders and other types of psychotic disorders had full financial ties to Big Pharma. And the reason that's important is because when it comes to mood disorders and other types of psychotic disorders, they are heavily treated with medications. And to have, you know, 100% of the people sitting on the panels determining what disorders get into the DSM all have ties to Big Pharma, that should make people uncomfortable. It makes me uncomfortable. The other part of it is that there was not one representative of the American Counseling Association on any of these panels. So there were, you know, LMFTs and there were psychologists or part of it, no counseling representatives. And when we think about mental health, most of the mental health care that we do on a regular basis is counseling. We counsel people through difficult times, through transitions in their life, through periods of grief, through loss. We counsel and guide. Therapy, as we think of therapeutic work, that deep dive into the psyche, is really done very rarely. Not many people do the years of deep psychoanalytic work or deep therapeutic work in their lifetime. Most people do 10 to 12 sessions or maybe 24 to work on, you know, anxiety or deep depression. But that deep psychotherapeutic work isn't often done. It's mostly counseling, mostly guidance, mostly mentoring. And the fact that we don't lean more into what the American Counseling Association looks at as mental, you know, proper mental health care or diagnosis is also something to be concerned about.
Elizabeth, we're starting to get some response for your request for calls.
And okay.
We have one standing by in just a moment, but we had one come in that did not want to be on the air.
Okay.
But the question was, talking about diagnoses, can your diagnoses be healed? If you are, say, diagnosed with anxiety, does that mean that you'll always have a mental illness?
That is a great question. It depends partly on whether or not you identify with that diagnosis and it becomes, you know,
defines
my story.
You, yeah.
Right, my story. Does it change if you've applied for health insurance on your behalf or health insurance has covered treatment? No, that forever remains in your dossier about your mental health care. So that becomes part of the story. If you go into see a different therapist, they're not necessarily going to have access to the records through managed care. But people quite often, you know, when they give their history, will say, I've had a history of anxiety. But the other challenge about that then is that the therapists are going to use kind of the confirmation bias of seeing you as someone who is anxious or anxiety is your main issue. And the problem with that is you might have your anxiety managed and be coming in for something else like grief or loss or transitions from one part of your life to another. But the therapist would focus on the anxiety response and not spend as much time focusing on the actual guidance or counseling piece of how do I manage these feelings of loss or sadness in my life. So the tough answer is there's never really a cure for anything, but there is an ability to live with and cope and overcome and have things in remission. So they're not a daily problem. I hope that's the best one.
Manage. So you can manage your diagnosis.
You can manage your diagnosis and how you decide that you want to, how much you want to make that diagnosis part of your story is under your control. But rarely, and again, I'm checking myself because I don't know if this is 100% true. But from my experience, there isn't really a time where a therapist will say, and now you are cured of depression,
right,
or now you are cured. I will no longer, you know, say that you have that. Like someone can reverse diabetes in their life. There isn't that same thing in mental health care where someone is now deemed to be healed from something and to never come back again.
I hope that answers our caller's question.
I hope it does too. Thanks for calling in. Our number is 805-781-3875. Lynn, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. I was listening a little bit ago and I turned off in order to be able to call in. So I haven't been hearing what you just said. But I was really concerned about the things you were talking about with therapists not dealing with, not being able to help people, that the diagnoses get in the way. I really was disagreeing with you almost 100% as you were first talking about all of this about 4 or 5 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. And tell me why.
And, well, I've been in the field a long time. I worked for County Mental Health as well as a private therapist. I see the change. I see people changing and figuring out who they are, what they need, how to take care of themselves. I don't think that the people I know and that I would refer people to as therapists, they don't treat people as if they're the first words out of their mouth, I have anxiety. They don't treat people according to one small piece of them or according to the DSM-5. They give a diagnosis, which is a general place to start. And then and that's for the billing. I personally only do pro bono now ever since COVID. But in the process of all of that, you listen to the person, you find out what they are, who they are, where they're going, where they want to be, where they don't want to be, and you help them get there. And people do get as well as they can from anything. They're not sitting in the same place year after year after year, if they're able to have someone that actually listens to them. And I believe that those people are in this county all over the place. So it's that when I was listening to you, I thought of somebody who hasn't had therapy, you may be talking them out of going and getting the help they need to find their own way. But to me, we don't cure people. People heal themselves. Do they get 100% out of any dilemma? No. Do we ever get out of grief? We get better with it. We get it so that it doesn't control our lives. So I was just frustrated that a lot of people may get turned off to getting therapy.
No, and I appreciate that. And I'm really glad you took the time to call in. I think you missed a little bit in the piece where I talked about people, you know, not getting fully healed, because there is never a fully healed, that it's always a process. I think that part of my story was about the use of the DSM and how limiting the DSM is in itself, because it doesn't offer treatment plans. It's just noting disorders. And yes, I agree, there are a lot of great clinicians out there that I refer to as well. But there are a lot of clinicians that are in institutionalized care that lean very heavily on DSM diagnoses, and they're leaning very heavily on very Western medicalized treatment that is not helpful. And if people are listening, and it's been my hope for 18 years doing this, that if people are listening, I want them to take their own mental health seriously and have all the tools they need to go in and find a clinician that's going to be right for them. And I think that's always my goal. It's not to dissuade people from going in for care. I mean, I'm a therapist myself. I don't want to dissuade people, but I want people to be more educated about what to look for. Like, what can they look for in a good clinician? What questions should they ask? And to not hand over their agency and just trust that someone with a license is going to be able to, you know, act on their behalf. So I think we have the same goals, this idea of people being able to heal themselves, but they have to have the right guide and the right support.
Or learn to trust themselves, that they actually have their own answers.
Mm-hmm.
They may be afraid to walk that path,
mm-hmm.
or they may meet resistance from the people in their lives, et cetera, and, along the journey to healing themselves and the ways they need to heal.
Mm-hmm.
We're all on a journey. I mean, life is one dang journey.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But it's just frustrating to me, because I really want people to seek the help they need, as opposed to thinking that, oh, well, everybody's going to just, you know, County Mental Health, 20 years with them taught me that, yeah, there are therapists that are new, green, not as good. They pass the test, but they really don't have what it takes.
Mm-hmm.
Those people tend to go into other professions. I've watched it happen over and over again. But the good people that stay with the county have been so wonderful in people's lives. And yes, there are people who are going to go out, not take the help that's offered, or have substance use that's impacting everything else, and that just kind of rules the nest. There's all kinds of things like that. But the individuals that I have worked with have been amazing, and we have seen so many people get better in taking care of themselves and their lives. So, and even the outreach to the homeless population, you're talking about institutionalized. You know, the homeless population has not been as institutionalized in recent years, but what they do is they go in and out of jail or in and out of shelter services, and they really, that homeless outreach programs that we have had over the years has made a huge difference for a lot of people, those that are willing and able to accept the help.
Yep. And again, I think we come to the same conclusion, is that we want to empower people to feel like they can take care of themselves if given the right tools or the right opportunities. But we want people to feel empowered and understand that no one can fix you. You have to be willing to do the work and find your way through whatever it is that you're struggling with in regarding your mental health.
It's definitely, you're not alone.
And you're not alone. There are a lot of caring, loving people out there. Lynn, thank you so much for taking the time to call.
Thank you.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about labels and how those labels can impact our lives, how we view ourselves, how we respond to the world, and how some help may or may not be supportive in a way that helps us to move beyond labels that have not been something that was supportive of our own mental health and well-being. And then in the simple terms, how about those labels that we pick up along the way through our family and through our friends? And do we really identify with those labels? And how do they impact our personality and the choices that we make? Our number is 805-781-3875. And is it Matt?
Yes.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thanks for having another great show. I just wanted to agree with you on how people can sort of put on their labels, like they sort of wear it. And I think it does in some ways hinder some people when they don't believe enough in themselves that they can get through something, and the label becomes the reason why they can't do it. I would never dissuade anybody from getting therapy, but it's sort of like the phenomenon when a doctor gives somebody a cancer diagnosis and says, you're going to be dead in 6 months, and they die on the day. And so it's very powerful, especially for these authority figures. And I think that, yes, the diagnosis needs to be there, but also the other half of it that's equally important is the empowerment of the individuals. Yes, you know, they should know their diagnosis, but also know that is not, you know, a jail sentence for them. There are ways to work with it and to be hopeful about the future.
So, Matt, if it weren't for the need for a treatment plan and diagnosis for managed care, do you feel the DSM serves the greater good?
Well, all in all, yes. But I think that there are some lacking elements of the self-empowerment of our individuals who need, yes, to know what's going on, to be able to negotiate with it, but also to know that they are empowered to thrive as much as possible, depending on what their condition is.
Yes, yes. So. To find that way to live our best life, even with those things that get in the way. I think, you know, everyone to some extent runs into that in their life.
Yes, because, you know, like you say, none of us are perfect.
Yeah. When I also think about, you know, the studies that have been done over the years of sending people in to different clinicians with similar symptoms and getting 5 or 6 different diagnoses, that always, you know, has rung very heavy in my mind, that there is a lot of subjectiveness to this entire process. And so although a diagnosis may help someone understand their behaviors more, it isn't necessarily a fact.
Yes, and also, too, like I know I really appreciate how you speak out about over-medication, too. It's not that medication isn't useful or appropriate at times, but we've all seen when somebody seems like a pen cushion for the pharmaceutical industry.
So, it hurts my heart. But again, nothing is all bad or all good. And it's how do we educate people so that they can make decisions that are much more educated. I'm just not about the blind trusting of someone just because they have letters after their name.
Yeah. Yeah, like, I mean, just a real quick anecdote. A friend of mine works for the fire department, and there's somebody who calls in at least a couple times a week, and there's never really anything particularly wrong with that person, but they're often given normalcycline, which is normal saline, and that makes the person feel soothed.
Yes. So. The placebo is a mighty, mighty tool.
Oh, yeah. It is. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling in, Matt. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And as we wrap up today, I just want to read for you the definition of a mental health or mental illness or mental disorder according to the DSM. This is the caveat at the beginning of the book. A mental disorder is a syndrome that impairs an individual's ability to think or to manage emotions and or behavior that reflects a dysfunction in psychological, biological or developmental processes underlying mental functioning. That's the basic. But underneath it, in the book, it states, and this is the caveat, behaviors that are expected responses to an event or stressor of some sort, and behaviors that are sanctioned within the client's culture, such as certain religious practices or grieving rituals, are not considered mental disorders. And so anyone who is considering and wondering about their own mental health and wanting to seek help, yes, seek help, but do your due diligence. Make sure that you read over that paragraph at the beginning of the DSM, because it's a book anyone can purchase. And make sure that before someone treats you, that what you're coming in for is truly a disorder, and not just, but actually a behavior, that it's an expected response to an event or stressor of some sort, and behavior sanctioned within the client's culture. Because my argument is 90% of what we struggle with are, number two, behaviors that are expected responses to an event or stressor. And those are not mental disorders. They are not pathological. You need counseling to help you navigate these experiences, but they are not a mental illness. And that, to me, is the essence of how we can take our mental health under our own advisement and not just hand it over to the profession. Make sure you're getting the treatment that suits what you're needing help with. And I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can find me by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. You can podcast our show. Please do. Go to Spotify, leave a review so more people can find us. And I look forward to continuing this conversation next week right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
I am not okay. I'm barely getting by. I'm losing track of days and losing sleep at night. I am not okay. I'm hanging on the rails. So if I say I'm fine, just know I learned to hide it well. I know I can't be the only one who's holding on for dear life. Not okay, but it's all gonna be alright. It's not okay, but we're all gonna be alright. I woke up today, I almost stayed in bed, had the devil on my back, and voices in my head. Some days it ain't all bad. Some days it all gets worse. Some days I swear I'm better off laying in that dirt. I know I can't be the only one who's holding on for dear life. But God knows I know when it's all said. Not okay, but it's all gonna be alright. It's not okay, but we're all gonna be alright. Gonna be alright. Gonna be alright. We'll see the other side. The pain will wash away in a holy water tide. And we all gonna be alright. I know I can't be the only one who's holding on for dear life. But God knows, I know when it's all said. Not okay, but it's all gonna be alright.